You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of June 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's show, from Iraq and Kenya to Uganda and back here in London, we'll discuss today's top news with Martin Plaut and Shashank Joshi. Then, to mark Monocle's annual Quality of Life edition, we've asked our editors and correspondents what makes a city great. Today, Sophie Grove gives her vote to the oddballs and eccentrics.
There's a friend of mine who chauffeurs punts up the Cam in the nude. A man who sprinkles lampposts with flour to ward off World War III. And I remember the man who used to patrol the streets near my school with a pint of milk strapped firmly to his head.
And as World War III hasn't happened, that lamppost flower must be good stuff. Also, we'll be reviewing the latest and greatest in the world of cinema with critic Anna Smith here in the studio. And we'll look back at the history of Latin America, from frontiers to football. And we might even play a song or two if time permits. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, coming up right now. Ahead of all that, Jonathan Wheatley has the world news.
President Obama is sending 300 military advisers to Iraq to help the Shia government combat Sunni insurgents. The president said US troops would not fight in Iraq, but that Washington was ready for targeted and precise military action if and when necessary. Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron said the crisis has developed because the Iraqi government has run the country on a sectarian basis.
I don't pick Iraq's leaders, the people of Iraq pick their leaders, but what matters is that those leaders, whoever they are now or in the future, run that country on a non-sectarian basis, because that running it on a more sectarian basis is part of the problem that is being dealt with today.
The United Nations said it was expanding aid to 1 million people driven from their homes as Islamist militants seized wide tracts of northern and western Iraq. The Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott said that his country would try to help Iraq if needed, amid reports that Australia had deployed a small contingent of about 12 troops to protect the Australian embassy in Baghdad.
No one should underestimate the seriousness of the situation in Iraq. This is a terrorist group seeking to create a terrorist state. And that would be a humanitarian catastrophe and a security nightmare for the region and for the wider world.
Other news now, a 20-year-old woman has been gang-raped, killed and hanged from a tree in Pakistan in a case with a chilling resemblance to a double rape and murder that caused outrage in neighbouring India last month. Pakistani police said Muzamil Bibi was attacked by three men in a field in the impoverished Leya area of the Punjab province. Several US agencies have announced rules on Friday that will grant new rights to same-sex couples throughout the United States, including survivor benefits and leave from work to care for a sick partner. The rules are being issued a year after the Supreme Court issued its landmark decision striking down a ban on national recognition of same-sex marriage. At the request of President Barack Obama, the agencies have reviewed more than 10,000 federal policies linked to marriage that could be changed to reflect the court's decision and extend rights to gay couples even in states that do not recognize same-sex marriage. Staying in the States, and art experts are trying to identify a mystery man whose portrait was discovered hidden under the Blue Room, a 1901 painting by Pablo Picasso. Researchers are hoping that material from the Musée Picasso in Barcelona and another museum in Paris will offer clues to solving the puzzle. Well, Susan Bendrins Frank is associate curator for research at the Phillips Collection in Washington, D.C.
What we're trying to understand by identifying this person is something about the circle of individuals that Picasso was interacting with at this very important moment early in his career, when he was just really beginning to make his name known.
And finally, tax authorities in Finland are turning to poetry in a bid to get more firms to file their tax returns electronically. Starting this summer, the Finnish Tax Administration will send a poem with a reminder that e-returns are possible. Roughly translated into English, it reads, "Pencil and eraser, no longer eraser. Electronic is in, a clear win, come and experience and drop your resilience." And that's the news here on Monocle 24.
A Thank you, Jonathan. Here's hoping that initiative does not catch on anywhere else. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We shall be back right after this. You're listening to Midori House. It's just gone 18:06 here in London, 13:06 in New York. Still Italy nil, Costa Rica one. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio, we have Martin Plaut, a fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies, and Shashank Joshi, a research fellow at RUSI, both voices familiar to Monocle 24 listeners. Welcome both. We will start in Iraq, while there's still an Iraq for us to start in. Latest reports suggest that fighting is still occurring in and around the oil refinery at Baiji and at the airport at Tal Afar. The United States has announced the dispatch of 300 military advisers, but has been careful to emphasize that they will not be sending combat troops. That is, that they will help Iraq fight, but not fight for them. And I guess the question which I'll put to you first, Shashank, is if the United States won't fight for the Iraqis, will the Iraqis?
Yes, they will. But the question is, which Iraqis? This is the problem. The army won't. The army is running around like headless chickens. Maliki sacked five commanders earlier in the week. So who will fight? Well, it's going to be those Shia militias that Maliki has called up to mobilise behind him and that the Iranians have been financing and backing for years and are now taking very seriously indeed. This is now the spearhead of the Iraqi fight back against ISIS and its various other Sunni militant allies. The problem is, the more this becomes a sectarian fight, the more Shias and Shia militias are leading the fight rather than national Iraqi institutions, the more that moderate, concerned Sunnis in the north and the west are driven into the arms of ISIS, because it just worsens that sense that we are facing a Shia Iranian-backed onslaught.
Martin, to bring you in, 6 years ago, 180,000 US soldiers couldn't avert civil war in Iraq. How are 300 going to manage?
I cannot imagine what they can do, and especially as they seem to be special forces, and what they're going to be doing sitting down looking at maps when these are the guys who are used to getting out and getting their boots dirty and doing something, I can't imagine. But there's another issue that arises from this, which is, as I understand it, ISIS is supported by the Turks. Now, if the Turks are supporting ISIS and the Americans are supporting Maliki, then don't we have a potential split within NATO?
We are getting through the looking glass on a number of fronts here where Iraq is concerned. But Shashank, again, you know, 300 doesn't seem like that many. Is the United States at this point just advising Iraq on how to close the door in the immediate sort of post-horse scenario?
No, I think what the 300 is about is, first of all, stiffening morale. You know, this is an army that's collapsed. This is going to provide a bit of sort of spine stiffening for these guys.
To stiffen their spines, you have to find them first. I mean, like, you know, the military, as you point, is no longer answering to its own
name. The Green Berets may be bringing some sort of surrogate spines with them. But I think really what's more important here is this is laying the groundwork for potential airstrikes if Obama feels Maliki has done enough to deserve those airstrikes, to earn them through political reform. Because you need those people on the ground to cue American drones or F-18s. You need those people on the ground to find the intelligence, because ISIS has struck at such speed that we saw the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, say earlier this week, we don't have enough intelligence on ISIS. They're in urban areas, hold up. We withdrew assets from Iraq years ago when we left. We don't know what's going on the ground entirely. So those 300 won't just be saying, come on, guys, fight up to the front, but they'll be there building up a picture of where ISIS is, who are they fighting with, who are their allies, who are the local tribes who've picked up a gun that day, and who are the hardened fighters who were veterans of campaigns in northern Syria, so that if the president decides Maliki has shown the goodwill to reform the Iraqi state and Baghdad is threatened and I'm going to strike, he has the ability to do that. That's what this 300 is about.
Martin Plout, does this look like a serious initiative by the United States, do you think, or them doing as close to nothing as they feel like they can get away with? Because from Barack Obama's point of view, I keep thinking he didn't vote for this war 10 years ago. He thought, well, 11 years ago, he thought it was a lousy idea 11 years ago. When he ran for president in 2008, if you told him that in 2014 you will again be thinking about whether to send American soldiers back, he'd have screamed, I'd have thought.
Well, that's the problem of running one of the superpowers. You have to deal with the issues that arrive on your plate. It's events, dear boy, events. You have to. there's no alternative to this. But, you know, the problem is that he does look weak. You know, sending in drones or sending in missiles, you know, looks powerful, looks strong. This is a much more difficult strategy. And once you have people on the ground, let's not forget the whole Vietnam War began with advisors. So you could be sucked back in if they get attacked.
I've got to say, speaking of the events, my favourite Private Eye cover from the last 15 years was one during the American occupation with the caption, "Shiite happens."
indeed, as they are discovering. But even if ISIS can be halted, and you would have to think, it does strike me that for a non-state militia, the advances they have made in the last couple of weeks are almost without precedent that I can think of in modern warfare.
It is. Well, don't forget the Taliban were a militia. Bust into Kabul, destroying other militias in the process. They were just some religious students who'd formed across the border a few years previously.
Which is also true, but Kabul at the time was a much more sort of knocked apart and ramshackle affair than Mosul is now.
I think what we may not have realised from the past month is that this isn't out of nowhere. Mosul was also a knocked-up affair. ISIS have been extorting money from businessmen and funding their activities in Mosul for a long time. And for the last 4 months, and I think we fully realise this, the entire province of Anbar, which includes Fallujah, Ramadi, this is western Iraq, by the way, has been out of bounds to government forces. They've been shelling cities indiscriminately. So ISIS didn't just turn up in a week. They have been slowly biding their time in Syria, building up their force in Anbar, and then they saw their opportunity and bust out.
Which does beg the question, though, does it not, of whether any force, let alone whatever of the Iraqi army, can be sort of corralled onto a parade ground in time in the near future, can actually reverse these games. Even if it's one thing to stop ISIS, but who is going to go about taking back Mosul and Tikrit?
Look, 7 or 8 years ago, Mosul, Tikrit, Anbar, these were all in al-Qaeda's hands. Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the organization that later became ISIS. How were they defeated? Well, partly by an injection of US troops, but more importantly by the so-called Sahwa, or awakening, which meant local Sunni tribes were paid and armed by the Americans to turn on their Sunni extremist brethren around them. You know, ISIS is so brutal, so vicious, there is every chance they will alienate people in Iraq just as they've alienated people in northern Syria. And if that happens, it's imperative that the Iraqi government takes the opportunity to exploit that division rather than bundling in and simply giving those Sunni communities a reason to bandwagon back with ISIS.
And do you think that the Iranians are going to allow Maliki to fall? That doesn't sound like it to me.
It's hard to see how that would be in Iran's interest, certainly. We do need to look at another, I guess, closer to home development in the drama in Iraq, which is the part being played in it by British citizens, a couple of whom have cropped up on what's actually quite a well-made video, a sort of recruitment advertisement for ISIS, featuring both British and what appears to be Australian jihadis. Their key slogans include "You're going to die anyway" and "The cure for depression is jihad," neither of which is quite "be all you can be," as these things go. But Martin, first of all, what did you make of their recruitment outreach?
Well, as you say, it looks pretty slick. I mean, I wish I could put together videos that look as good as that.
These young folk with their iPhones.
No, I know, appalling. But, you know, this kind of issue has been raised for many, many years. You only have to go back to the Spanish Civil War. You have to look at the people who went in and, for example, from Britain and supported the anti-apartheid movement and the ANC in South Africa. So this is a long, long tradition of people going off and fighting. I mean, I've just come back from the United States and I was looking at some of the archives. In 1900, young American kids were going off and fighting with British forces in South Africa in the Boer War. Amazing. So, I mean, there's nothing new in any of this.
Shashank, is it the case, though, has, I guess, that the technology that they've used to produce and disseminate this video, has it made the idea of running away to join a foreign war seem, I guess, easier? I mean, you know, yeah. 10, 20, 30 yeah. years ago, you would have actually needed to know something, whereas now you're probably thinking, you know, a cheap ticket to Turkey, a bus ride to the border. Yeah. You can email these people in advance.
I think it's fairly glamour. You know, these guys are looking at Instagram, Twitter. They're looking at really flashy photos of some young guy from Birmingham living up in Mosul with an AK-47 and a pile of cash. This is really attractive. It sounds fun. They don't see the videos of people bleeding to death painfully over days, shot to death by Iraqi special forces. And the second point is, this isn't Afghanistan. This is on Europe's southern flank. The border between Iraq and Syria is porous. The border between Syria and Turkey is porous. I don't think they're supporting ISIS, but I do think they have a lax control of their border.
I've spoken to people who've flown into the airports in the south, especially in Gaziantep, yeah. where no one's even bothering to check passports.
Absolutely. And the Turks have, I should say, now, in the recent weeks and in the last month, they've clamped down because they realise the danger this poses. They can't just back some Syrian rebels because they know that that will allow more extreme groups like ISIS through as well. But the point is, it's really not very hard to get to Syria. It's hard to get to Afghanistan in the same way. So ease of access makes a big, big difference.
I bet it'll be hard to get out.
It'll be very hard to get out. So I think you'll be going out in the back in a coffin.
Martin Plough, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, David Cameron, has this week been talking up the threat of ISIS, saying that they do pose a threat to Europe and talking about the threat posed by British-born jihadis going there and returning home. Is that something that is a huge concern? I mean, people who volunteered for the international brigades in the Spanish Civil War, while acknowledging that all conflicts are different, did not then come back to Britain and blow things up here.
But then they didn't see Britain as part of a crusader army that was coming to wipe out their religion. So, you know, the problem is that these people are now hardline fanatics. And, you know, they will stop at nothing. They're just the kind of people who planted bombs on our buses. In fact, blew up a bus in one of the most, shall we say, Muslim areas of London. You know, I mean, Edgware Road.
Indeed. But you don't think that this might be largely a case of somewhat dim, vainglorious young men getting something out of their system?
I wish I thought that was true.
But that's still a dangerous thing, you know?
Indeed.
ISIS encourages lone wolf attacks. OK, they may not be 9-11s or liquid bomb plots, but, you know, we saw in the Jewish Museum in Brussels only a couple of weeks ago a young man who'd fought with ISIS stabbed people to death. And, you know, terrorism is not about numbers or necessarily about scale. It's about the psychological effect it has. And the Woolwich killings, I think, demonstrated to us how one act can be so psychologically devastating.
Indeed. Well, the most recent Iraq crisis has created several hundred thousand new refugees just in time for World Refugee Day, which is today. Around the world, more than 50 million people are now classified as forcibly displaced by conflict, which is the highest number recorded since World War II. One of the biggest sources of that, most recent sources, is the 2.5 million from Syria, which has given that number a real bump. Martin Plough, it's a perennial political question here in the UK, the idea of to what extent any of this needs to be our problem, what our obligations are to people fleeing conflict. Do rich Western countries do enough?
I think we all have an obligation. We cannot turn our backs on people for two reasons. First of all, because we are all human beings and we have a humanitarian drive, which we should engage with. I mean, you know, the major engagement for all of these people, whether it's Afghanistan, Somalia, across the world, is in the third world. It is the poorest of the poor who are giving the most to assist these people. So we have a massive obligation in order to do. We have plenty. We should do what we can. The other reason is, quite frankly, what we are seeing in across Europe, which is people pouring out of these conflicts and coming across the Mediterranean at huge risk, dying in their tens and hundreds and perhaps even thousands. I mean, there was a report recently that 1,000 Eritreans and Syrians were arriving in Holland every week. Now, that is a massive impact on Holland. It's nothing like the impact that's being felt in Jordan, where it's not just 1,000, but probably tens, if not hundreds of thousands coming across. But we, you know, it is a big issue. We have to deal with this now in these areas where the conflict is, rather than having to put up these people here.
Shashank, to, I guess, return this question to our first story about the obligations of countries where the current mess in Iraq is concerned, Could you argue that in terms of helping to stop refugee outflow, there is a self-interested argument for involving ourselves in conflicts such as Iraq and indeed Syria?
Yes, although, of course, experience has shown that certain types of intervention can accelerate and deepen that flow of refugees very, very substantially. The Iraq War of 2003 is a great example. I mean, of course, that was a case where you had a stable country. In unstable countries, yes, intervention can do that. Kosovo, I think, is a very good example. And, you know, I think there's a national security imperative here as well. You go back to a big refugee crisis stemming from the formation of the State of Israel and Palestinian refugees. Well, those Palestinian refugees, though their refugee camps in places like Jordan, became major sites for radicalization, recruitment to militant organizations, to the point where, you know, in Black September, Jordan had to go in and move militarily against these camps. In Lebanon, you're seeing that today.
The same true of those huge refugee cities that have been in Pakistan for years and years.
Of course, the Taliban, who I just mentioned in their drive across into Kabul, they were formed in those refugee camps, and that had a devastating effect on Afghanistan's history.
And the same is true in Kenya with the Somalis.
Indeed. Well, we'll take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Martin Plout and Shashank Joshi will still be here when we get back. And up next, on the other side of these promos, we will be in Kenya.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got the curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator, here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Martin Plout from the Institute of Commonwealth Studies and Shashank Joshi from RUSI. We'll look now at Kenya, where rather depressingly, Kenya's government is urging people to watch World Cup games at home rather than at bars or parties. This follows attacks in and around the coastal resort of Mpeketoni, which left more than 60 people dead. Martin Plout, first of all, we are currently now in looking at a blame game without precedent that I can think of, where that al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for these attacks. President Kenyatta claims that al-Shabaab didn't do it, after which al-Shabaab have said, yes, we did. I can't think of a sophisticated question. What on earth is going on here?
Well, I'm afraid I think it is al-Shabaab that is involved in this, but they may also be doing, shall we say, the enemies of the president a favour. Because what's, you know, you mustn't forget that there are huge ethnic tensions inside Kenya. In 2007, it was this exploded in huge post election violence. And, you know, many Kikuyu were killed. The president comes from the Kikuyu tribe. And in a sense, he is saying, look, it's our people that are being targeted. But his opponents, people like Raila Odinga, are coming out saying, hang on, you know, you're just saying this because you want to whip up the Kikuyu and the Kalenjin and other people in that kind of group against us. You are stoking the fires of ethnic hatred once again. So the whole thing becomes an absolutely, it's a powder keg. And I think it's extremely dangerous what he's doing.
This, Shashank, this is somewhat bizarre behaviour, to say the very least, on President Kenyatta's part, isn't it? Is there a kind of, I guess, cynical political logic of the sort Martin is describing there at work here, or has he just genuinely parted company with reality?
No, I agree with Martin. You know, I think he'll be exceptionally worried about the effect this has on his country's tourism industry, which is going to suffer very greatly from this. But overall, for lots of leaders like this who faced militancy that for us would be a sort of grave high-level national security problem, we don't realise there is really strong local, you know, local political currents that shape how these people respond. We see it in Afghanistan, and the way Karzai responds to things in very unpredictable ways. And it's because he's responding to local political incentives. You know, that's why he sort of veers off these paths so often.
Martin Platt, is it possible, though, that this may just goad al-Shabaab further into them thinking, well, if you won't take that seriously,
I think that they are using everything that they can to throw at him because, I mean, don't forget that you have the Kenyan troops inside Somalia. They see that as the major reason why they are attacking Kenya. So that they are pushing across the border to bring the fight back home to him. And there are plenty of young Somalis who are in Kenya, who are alienated. Some of them lived in the Dadaab refugee camp up on the border. I mean, it's, I don't know, 700,000-800,000 people. Some of them have been living there all their lives. It's a hellhole. And you then have people in place like Eastleigh in Nairobi, which is a very strong Somali community. And, of course, the more that they get picked on, the more they feel alienated. And, you know, there have been hundreds been picked up. So the whole thing is just a cycle of violence.
OK, well, we should move along to Uganda. Earlier this year, of course, Uganda passed a series of bizarre laws against homosexuality, accompanied by a sequence of equally deranged pronouncements on the subject by President Yoweri Museveni. The United States has now reacted by announcing that Uganda will have to do without some of the American aid to which it had become accustomed. Shashank, first of all, is this likely to impress Uganda one way or the other?
I don't know precisely how much Uganda depends on these funds, but I think that, speaking of local political incentives, the local political elites there will care far, far, far more about what their electorate, what their domestic constituencies feel about this issue than any loss of aid overall. Whatever that sum may be, I think that the net effect of this will be popularity. I was in Uganda a couple of months ago, and you can lift up any newspaper on any given day, and the sort of average headline would read something like, homos party in defiance of law, homos target the state, and I could even more offensive headlines than this, which gives you a flavour, I think, of local sensitivities on this issue.
A Pew survey in 2013 found that 96% of Ugandans believed homosexuality unacceptable. That was just behind the continent high of 98% in Nigeria, only in inverted commas.
And I don't think one defies figures like that for a few hundred million dollars.
Only 61% in South Africa believe it's unacceptable. Martin, where does this extraordinarily virulent homophobia in Africa come from, and is it likely to change anytime soon?
No, it's certainly not likely to change anytime soon, and it is one of the most depressing things about Africa. The one good thing about South Africa, I would say, is there is a genuine commitment to equality of between people of different persuasions. For example, men can marry men in South Africa.
But South Africa is a special case. If that hadn't been codified in the early 1990s, South Africa might also have been a different case.
I completely agree. Yeah. But, I mean, the ANC has stuck by the Constitution.
Yeah. Well, finally then, Martin, you believe have just come from the High Court.
I have.
Where judgment was expected in the case brought by 15,000 Nigerians against Shell over two
oil not quite
spills.
A preliminary judgment.
Preliminary judgment.
This was some of the biggest oil spills ever in the Niger Delta. Shell was responsible, except that they were responsible, has offered £30 million to clean it up. The Lee Day, who are taking this case on behalf of the Bodo people, say they want $300 million. And really, Lee Day made some mileage today because the judge agreed that indeed they do have a case. The Shell could not be held responsible for protecting and for acting like a police or a military to protect the pipeline, but there were things they could do. For example, they could install devices to check when a rupture had occurred. And, I mean, for example, if a rupture happens in Europe, you press a button, the pipeline stops. Some of these spills went on for weeks. I'm told for up to 6 weeks, some of these spills, without anybody doing anything. You can imagine how this devastated an area of mangrove swamps. It's some of the worst pollution that there's ever been. And this is what the firm is now trying to get on behalf of the Bodo people, and 15,000 of whom have had their lives ruined.
Shashank Joshi, this is potentially an important precedent, is it not, for, I guess, Africans requiring restitution against corporations who've been, as Martin suggested, playing by different rules on their continent than they would elsewhere?
Yes, I think corporate governance is a really significant issue here. We've seen it in East Africa in terms of dumping of waste. We've seen it across the continent. I think it's particularly important in these places because local political structures are more vulnerable to corruption, more vulnerable to being bribed by these companies, by these corporations, to have laxer laws, laxer regulations. So
not that we're accusing Shell of bribing anyone, of course.
But of course, I'm certainly not accusing Shell in particular of any misdemeanors here, but I think it's safe to say levels of corruption in these countries are extremely high, and that makes them vulnerable in terms of these protections. So they need the additional protections afforded by recourse to courts here, if I think, and I think it's a very good thing.
So finally then, and just fairly briefly, Martin, what happens next with this case?
Well, now they have to go and find some of the evidence, because this was heard on principle. None of the actual evidence of the spill was put before the judge. But if I was Shell, I'd be worried, because Lee Day, who brought the case, has already taken Anglo-American to court. They've taken Cape Asbestos to court. They've won a lot of money for their clients.
Martin Plout and Shashank Joshi, thank you both very much for joining us here at Midori House.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House, which certainly, I suspect, sounds like it's going to be more exciting than the next 20 minutes of this football match is going to be. Still Costa Rica 1, Italy 0. We will have the latest of in our series of quality of life essays, and we'll meet the author of An Alternative History of South America and review the latest movie releases. But before we get started on all that, Jonathan Wheatley has the headlines.
Thank you. President Obama sending 300 military advisers to Iraq to help the Shia government combat Sunni insurgents. The president said US troops would not fight in Iraq, but that Washington was ready for targeted and precise military action if and when necessary. The United Nations says it was expanding aid to 1 million people driven from their homes as Islamist militants seized wide tracts of northern and western Iraq. A 20-year-old woman has been gang-raped, killed and hanged from a tree in Pakistan in a case with a chilling resemblance to a double rape and murder that caused outrage in neighbouring India last month. Pakistani police said Muzamil Bibi was attacked by 3 men in a field in the impoverished Leyeh area of Punjab province. And several US agencies announced rules today that would grant new rights to same-sex couples throughout the United States, including survivor benefits and leave from work to care for a sick partner. And these rules also included states that do not recognize same-sex marriage at the moment. And that's latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Jonathan. Welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24, 21:32 in Moscow, 18:32 here in London, 14:32 in Rio. The latest edition of Monocle magazine is on newsstands now, and it's a big one. It's our annual quality of life survey, and all this week we've been asking our editors and correspondents what makes a city good or bad. And today, Monocle senior editor Sophie Grove explains why the real test of a city's character is how it treats its oddballs and eccentrics.
My hometown of Cambridge is well known for its academic prowess. But beyond the cloisters and libraries is a city that breeds eccentricity. Cambridge envelops the shambolic, the expansive, the dishevelled, and the very nearly mad into its urban fabric. It tolerates hoarders, oddballs, and exhibitionists, whether they're buskers or inventors. This could well be down to the city's density of Nobel Prize-winning scientists, whose concern is more with the cosmos than proper civic conformity. For instance, on my street there's a celebrated mathematician who's worked on a theory so complex it's been christened the monster. He's a genius. He's also obsessed with bus timetables and tours the networks of England, carrying all his possessions in a large plastic shopping bag and campaigning for better transport. There's a friend of mine who chauffeurs punts up the Cam in the nude, a man who sprinkles lampposts with flour to ward off World War III, and I remember the man who used to patrol the streets near my school with a pint of milk strapped firmly to his head. My other glorious neighbour had a rat and a large snake as pets and was virtually nocturnal. The presence of eccentrics in any city is crucial. They puncture the norm and shake up social hierarchies. They say more than any mayor or police chief could about identity, tolerance, or diversity. That would-be disruptive characters can continue as they wish in a city is a vivid demonstration of a society's strength of character. Cities are flexible, resilient beasts, and the greatest of them can absorb and celebrate the odd, quirky character with a casual charm. Recently, I was in a cafe on the Piazza del Popolo in Rome when a man strolled in for his morning coffee with a large white cat sitting on his head. No one minded, and he took his caffeine fix and cornetto standing at the bar before heading on his way. The white-suited waiters didn't blink an eye. This tacit liberalism is what makes a society thrive and keeps it interesting. Of course, we need the norm-observing masses to keep things ticking over. Eccentrics aren't ruinous anarchists, and cities rely on rules to some extent. That a city encourages some civic dissent should be a mark of pride. That it takes it nonchalantly in its stride is all the better. Oddballs in Cambridge aren't made into local celebrities. They are simply encouraged and absorbed by the rest of the Cambridge population, who are a little weird too, if we're being honest. For Monocle, I'm Sophie Grove.
Sophie Grove on the role of oddballs, eccentrics and indeed outright dingbats in our great cities. Up next, we'll be talking football and frontiers in Latin America.
At the 2014 World Cup in Brazil, these are something we'll be hearing a lot of over the 4 weeks of the tournament. But what are the alternative national songs that bind the nations taking part in the World Cup together?
There is one song that every South Korean knows, and that is the old folk song, Arirang.
We can dissent with our country, but we can be patriotic while doing it.
Monocle 24 brings you a series of special reports on the unofficial anthems that capture the spirit of the 32 nations battling it out in Brazil.
When people come out with some Advance Australia Fair, everybody kind of looks at each other and thinks, what country is that? Whereas if it's Waltzing Matilda, no problem.
That's the World Cup's alternative national anthems throughout the World Cup here on Monocle 24.
Art as a tool to fix our lives? Alain de Botton believes it is. Monocle Films meets the philosopher in the Rijks Museum in Amsterdam, where visitors are introduced to this new therapeutic look at art.
It's not therapy in the sense of, you know, three times a week on a couch. It's therapeutic in the very loose sense of the word. Sometimes in our own life, we're like up against our problems, we feel a bit claustrophobic. So a picture of a wide open view can for a moment just open our minds and open ourselves to better horizons.
Art is therapy. Now playing in the film section on monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Now, football is, of course, a global game. The clue is in the name World Cup, but it's arguable that South America, a portion of which is hosting the current tournament, plays and watches the game with a particular exuberance and intensity. But where does that South American passion and affinity for football come from, and what sustains it now? Well, better placed than most to answer that question is Matthew Brown, author of From Frontiers to Football, an alternative history of Latin America since 1800. And Matthew joins me now from Quito. Matthew, first of all, your book sort of is not just about football, we should be clear. It's a sort of a fairly expansive history of the continent since 1800. Since this World Cup began, since it was announced, people watching the World Cup from overseas have been treated to the full panoply of, you know, old school South American stereotypes. How accurate are those as a reflection of modern South America?
Well, I think it's fair to say that they're completely inaccurate. Nevertheless, stereotypes often are built from a grain of truth. I mean, I'm watching the World Cup coverage from within South America, so of course there are far fewer of those continent-wide stereotypes, but Ecuadorians buy into stereotypes about Brazil, which are all based about the Copacabana beach, which I'm sure you're seeing back in the UK. As well. But no, the 21st century Latin America is a part of the globalized world. So there are shopping malls down the road from where I am in Quito, which put anything in my hometown of Bristol to shame, really. So I think that the kind of things that we're seeing, that you see on the screens, which to us speak of Latin America, samba, exoticism, the stereotypes about incomplete stadiums and lazy workers, I mean, they all come out of the 19th century when people in Britain and the United States first traveled to the continent and then wrote the first travel books, first illustrated travel books. So that's what the book tries to do, to show how we got to where we are now and how the roots of the image that Latin America has and the rest of the world come out of the mid-19th century with the communications revolution and the travellers of that period.
Your book is called From Frontiers to Football, thereby emphasising the importance that football does have in modern South America and to modern South America. How useful is it, the history of football in South America, as a means of understanding the continent's history?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely vital to understanding the continent's history. The reason that football is so important is across much of Latin America, although not all of Latin America, there are exceptions like Venezuela and Cuba, where baseball is the national sport, is that the global spread of football at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, occurs just at the same time that Latin American states are undergoing a period of nation building, joining up their capitals to their ports with railways. And so football arrives as this new way of expressing the meaning of a nation. So, for example, Brazil abolishes slavery only in 1888. So right at the time when people are starting to play football, there's this new sense of equality between the citizens of the country. So there's this new thing of what does it mean to be Brazilian, and the way that Brazilians play football comes to express that Brazilianness more than anything else, with the possible exception of music. So the book has a lot about football and a lot about music, just as it has a lot about railways and coffee exports and dictatorships and all those other things that we think of as being intrinsically Latin American.
In South America in general, and not necessarily just in football, although given that there's a World Cup on, we'll talk about football, but also in terms of politics and music and culture, has there been a process of homogenization? I ask this because I can remember when you watched a World Cup 20, 30 years ago, even other European teams were just always an incredible surprise, and they all had a discrete character because you never heard of any of these players or any of these teams anywhere else except other than at World Cups, whereas now everybody can watch everybody all the time. Is South America becoming more like one continent than a bunch of different countries?
I think there's definitely a sense in which football cultures have become globalised and homogenised, therefore there is becoming one way of playing at national level. But then if you think about the Ecuadorian national, well, let's think about the Brazilian national team. Most of them play in Europe in the major leagues, Spain, the UK, Italy, and Germany. The Ecuadorian national team, though, which is a much more peripheral country to the globalized economy, play in Qatar, Mexico, a couple in the UK. They're much more spread around. The Christian Noboa, one of the best players, plays in Russia. So they are even more globalized than the Brazilians, who just go to the centre, and therefore they remain much more unknown as a kind of generalizable quantity of what it means to be Ecuadorian. So in a way that puts them at a disadvantage because they're not part of the global centre of football. But when they come up against teams like Switzerland and Honduras, they remain a sense of being an unknown quantity. And the same, I think, goes for the Costa Ricans now.
The Costa Ricans are fast becoming an extremely known quantity. There's going to be a lot of very busy agents over the next few weeks, I suspect. Just finally, Martin, if you were backing one South American team to progress in this World Cup, who would it be?
Yeah, well, I put my money on Colombia about a year ago. And that was before their best player, Falcao, was injured and out of the World Cup. Nevertheless, their first two matches, they've been fantastic. And Colombia is in a very special position at the moment. They've just had presidential elections, which became a referendum on the peace process with the FARC, who've been waging a 50-year guerrilla war on the Colombian state. And the players are extremely conscious of the role of football in unifying the Colombian nation at this particular moment of the Colombian peace process. So my money's on them, and I think were they to win the World Cup, it would also have an immense contributory factor in taking that peace process forward. Colombia is the only country in Latin America which still has an ongoing left-wing guerrilla movement. It's high time that was over, and football has already had a part in bringing that to an end, in ensuring that a pro-peace candidate won the presidential election last week. And let's see how far that goes.
Matthew Brown, thank you very much for joining us. That's Matthew Brown, author of From Frontiers to Football, an alternative history of Latin America since 1800. Time now for some music. We'll stay in Latin America, specifically Brazil. This is the Brazilian singer-songwriter Seu with a song which could have been about the way the Italians have been playing this evening at Somnambulo. That was Seu with Somnambulo. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, 1850 here in London. Still Costa Rica 1, Italy 0 as we head into injury time. It's time now to review the best, occasionally the worst, in the worlds of the arts. Today it's the turn of cinema. Joining me now is the film critic Anna Smith. Anna, first of all, Chinese Puzzle, the third in a trilogy.
Correct, yes. It's a trilogy which sort of reminded me of Richard Linklater's Before Sunrise, Before Sunset. It's about a guy with relationship problems, played by Romain Duris, but it's perhaps slightly less romantic than that. In this one, we see him in New York. He's split up with his wife. He's followed his kids to New York so he can be with him. But he's a Frenchman in New York. He's not fitting in very well. So it's kind of a fish out of water comedy, if you will.
That doesn't sound terrifically funny so far. You've just painted a picture of a man in exile, his life crumbling around him.
It could have been that film, couldn't it? But luckily, the writing's very sharp. There's quite a lot of physical comedy. You know, he gets a job as a bike courier, crashes around town. I found it much funnier when it gets into kind of green card territory, because he's forced to marry a Chinese American girl in order to, you know, get a visa. And you see a lot of that humorous, as we saw in Green Card, attempts to fool the authorities and convince them that it's a relationship. It's a very light touch throughout. You know, this man wears his sorrows very lightly, both in terms of the director and the star. So it's good fun, actually. It's very sharp.
When you talk about Green Card, my own views of that have been somewhat tarnished by the fact that I remember once being doing a series of work assignments in America and getting Green Card on, I kid you not, 5 consecutive flights.
Oh, no,
and this,
yes.
And this was before multi-channel things in the back of seats. I became somewhat wearied of it. How much hay do they make of the French stereotypes?
Well, obviously, it's from a French director, so they don't make too much of that.
Fewer of them,
I would say. There's probably more of the American stereotypes, you know, these big bumbling New Yorkers who are sort of crashing into everything. And there's a very amusing scene where Romain Duris' character meets his girlfriend's new boyfriend, and you expect him to be horrible, but he's crushingly nice. And it's just a funny scene where this tiny little Frenchman and this huge American one, and he's actually just really overly nice.
Okay, well, we have a clip of this which we can hear now.
I can't stay here. I've met someone in New York. And I'm taking the children.
Au revoir, Papa.
I have to figure out how I can see my children.
Hi. I just wanted to say I love your kids.
You and I have a lot to say to each other.
Yeah.
A clip there from Chinese Puzzle, the first of the selection today by guest film critic Anna Smith. Is it necessary to have seen the first two in this sequence to derive enjoyment from this?
I don't think it is. I think it would help if you have some affection for the characters. And there's a point where Audrey Tautou comes in, who we all know as a character. If you hadn't seen the previous films, you might wonder exactly who she is. It soon becomes clear she's an ex. But no, I think you can enjoy it on its own terms. It's a slightly rambling film. I mean, it seems a little bit aimless.
French film.
Yeah, it's freewheeling, if you prefer. But I found it funny enough to compensate for the sort of leisurely pace.
Okay, well, the second one you've selected today seems like it's going to be a little bit less leisurely. It's a horrible pair of words to try and say together. It's just I have to say, reading the précis of this film, which is The Art of the Steal, did make me laugh because it does sound like the kind of film I just imagined a Hollywood pitch meeting coming up with in 10 minutes before lunch. It's just like, yeah, Kurt Russell, who is unbelievably still employed, this is a descent into self-parody. As it says here, third-rate motorcycle daredevil and semi-reformed art thief by the name of Crunch Calhoun.
Brilliant. I know.
Yeah, I know. This is one of those things that's, it's obviously going to be terrible. Is it great, terrible, or just terrible?
It's actually, I wouldn't say it's terrible. It's
really
watchable because it is actually a crime comedy. You know, they're not taking it too seriously throughout. It is incredibly derivative, as you suggest. I mean, you feel like you've seen all this before
many, many times. He's a daredevil.
Yeah.
We'll call him Crunch Calhoun or something. That'll do.
He's some random attractive girlfriend in the background. We
obviously
don't really get to know who she is. Matt Dillon is the brother who's a bit crazy.
Obviously.
And they have get together for one last job. You know, no cliche left unturned. But actually, again, the writing is sufficiently funny that if you're watching it on airplane, you might carry on. I don't suggest necessarily going to pay to see it in the cinema.
Okay. No danger of me doing that. We have a clip of The Art of the Steal.
Ladies and gentlemen, Crunch Calhoun!
As a young buck, I thought I'd make history.
Great men don't take dives for a couple hundred bucks.
I'll give you $700.
11.
6.
8.
Deal.
You wanted to know when I was ready to go back to work. Well, I'm ready. First thing you need is an idea man, and ours was Nicky, my half-brother. Now there's Patty McCarthy. He's the guy who knows any guy you need to know. And Guy de Cornet is our forger.
And you are who?
He's my apprentice.
So you're a wizard now.
He could have been a contender. Kurt Russell is Crunch Calhoun, a phrase I don't think I would ever tire of. A good aeroplane movie, you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's a popcorn Friday movie. It's very dumbed down. You know those heist movies where they explain how everything happened in laborious flashback, which you've already sort of worked out.
In this one, they can't even be bothered?
Well, no, it goes on for about 10 minutes. You're like, okay, I get the message. I know what happened.
Do they do that whole kind of repeated pointless exposition thing? So I'm a big, big sucker for that. I think Con Air is the benchmark.
Yes, quite a lot of that.
Yeah,
yes.
All those people
you'd
shouting, we put all these dangerous men on a plane for some reason.
Yeah, it's for very short attention spans.
Excellent. As indeed has been most of Kurt Russell's career, which has been weirdly enduring. Finally, Chef, starring Jon Favreau, clearly what is known as a feel-good comedy, which tend, funnily enough, to make me feel extremely bad. Is this a feel-good comedy that will make you feel good, or should one take a bucket without popcorn in it?
It will make you extremely hungry, I'll tell you
okay.
that. It is moderately feel-good. It's about a guy's relationship with his son. Jon Favreau is a director, star, writer, everything. It's almost like he's mirroring his own career. He was directing Iron Man, now he's doing a small indie movie. His character is an LA chef who's doing very well, but tiring of the glitz and the glamour and gets a bad review, gives it all up, decides to go on the road and have a street van full of, you know, Cuban food, delicious, authentic. There's a lot of almost live-time cooking. You know, you feel like you're actually watching it from the start of the recipe. So it really is literally mouthwatering. Do not go hungry.
Okay, well, we do have a clip of that. This is Chef, starring Jon Favreau.
Wow, am I feeling good, man. Let me say this.
This is madness, huh?
There's carne asada. Check it out.
Wow.
Chef Big Dog up all night cooking.
Shut up and taste this. A mousse douche. Come here, guys.
Look at that. You like it?
Yeah.
We're going to cook like this.
We're being reviewed by the most important critic in the city.
Now suddenly you're going to be an artist. Well, be an artist on your own time. It's my restaurant.
The kitchen is my domain. That was our deal.
The deal has now changed. Either you stay or you go.
So you're threatening to fire me now?
No, I'm telling you what I'm prepared to do if you don't cook my menu.
Sounds like Jon Favreau in a radical departure there, playing a likeable everyman.
He is very likeable and sufficiently funny.
And the film is likeable?
Yeah, it's sweet, it's cute, yeah.
Chef, starring Jon Favreau, the final choice of our guest film critic, Anna Smith. Thank you very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks to our earlier guests, Martin Plaut and Shashank Joshi. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. The researchers were Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Johan Lau. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Next up, after the headlines, we have Marcus Hippie and The Menu.
All the stuff I do is quite traditional, but with a little bit of a twist. So take things like a trifle, taking lovely fresh English strawberries, marinating them, and then putting white chocolate through the custard and putting kirsch into the cream.
For this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.